Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello folks, Ben here. Thanks for joining me for episode 42 of A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. This week I chat with London-based German photographer Philipp Eberling about his two book projects, the most recent of which, London Ends, has just been published by Fishbar Books, the imprint that Philipp runs with his wife, Magnum photographer Olivia Arthur. Just quickly, before all that, in the absence of any other sponsors around here, which is an issue I will eventually get around to addressing, this episode of the podcast is sponsored by me. Bear with me. One of the things I do is website creation and development, which is something I have learnt to do over many years of building my own websites and those of friends and acquaintances. More specifically, I now specialise in doing Squarespace websites. So if you need a website, let me know. Most of you will be familiar with Squarespace, especially you podcast fans, because as it happens, they themselves are probably the world's most enthusiastic sponsor of podcasts. Many of you will already be happily using them. They're not the only option. They're not necessarily the cheapest option, but for flexibility, for the design options they offer, for the simplicity and intuitive nature of their content management, they are probably the best option, whether you're a photographer, designer, business person, or online retailer. Now, I know you can do it yourself. That, after all, is the whole point. But there is a learning curve, and there is a time cost to that. So if you want a new website, but you don't have the time or the inclination to figure out how to do it yourself, that's where I can help. I will help you design it. I will build it. I will copy edit any dodgy written content. I will show you how to then go away and manage it yourself. And I will offer you support after the fact. What's more, simply because I'm not a full-time web developer, I'll do all that for significantly less than the competition will charge you. Email me at bensmithphoto.com for details. Also, if you're a regular listener, or even if you aren't, and if you like the podcast but you haven't left a review on iTunes, please open iTunes, go to the podcast page and leave a very brief review. While you're there, just hit the subscribe button if you haven't done that already, regardless of how you listen. This, in theory, can raise the profile of the podcast, hopefully bring new listeners, which in turn will help me to attract sponsors other than myself, which is all a bit meta and, frankly, slightly embarrassing. You can also make a one-off donation or sign up for a small recurring subscription on the website, and we're talking £3 a month here, all of which helps towards the cost of making it. So my guest this week, Philipp Eberling, grew up in a small village in Germany before making his escape to London at the age of 19, where he took a degree in photography at the London College of Printing. He subsequently won the Observer Hodge Award, which kick-started his career as a jobbing editorial portrait photographer. In 2010, along with his wife Olivia Arthur, who featured on episode 11 of the podcast, he founded Fishbar, a bookshop, gallery space and photo book publisher here in East London. His first book, published under the Fishbar imprint, was Land Without Past, a deeply personal photographic essay on growing up in a small village in the north of Germany and a meditation on the relationship contemporary Germany has with its past. The new book is about the forgotten parts of London. Leaving behind the landmarks of the centre, London Ends takes the viewer on a journey to the places where the city ceases to be a city and becomes a series of amalgamated villages. So here's Philipp discussing all of those things and more. I hope you enjoy it. We started off talking about Fishbar.
The business side is fun too, and I enjoy, actually. I enjoy doing the business side of Fishbar, and it is just... I mean, that's where the biggest mistakes happen, and we're fully aware of it, but that doesn't save us from making them.
You know,
distribution, cost control, product range, all these things have suddenly become vital.
Mm.
And it's not what you want to spend your time thinking about, but you have to.
Yeah, of course.
And also think about the audience. I mean, you know, when that's become the sort of key thing in what we do whenever we talk about publishing. I mean, we do workshops with people, sort of bookmaking workshops. The one key thing we always talk about is think about the audience.
Mm.
Because when you're an artist, or you know, you're a photographer, whichever you want to call you, it's totally okay to make a piece of work for yourself, which you don't worry about the audience. That's totally okay. However, if you want to keep it for yourself forever, then that's fine. If you don't, then it'll be released into the world and it will either live or die. And if you want it to live, you have to think about the audience.
Mm.
And that is, I mean, something we learned as publishers and also, I suppose, as photographers who wanting to be published by other people. And I think it's a key message we always try to teach students when we teach.
Yeah, and it almost seems obvious, but you can see why it might be the sort of thing that gets overlooked in all the conglomeration of things that you have to consider.
Yeah, it's being overlooked. I mean, I understand why, because to find your unique voice means you have to listen to yourself a lot and figure out what it is that you're going to say. And that also means you can't constantly think about how the outside world is going to perceive what you're doing or where it's going to fit in. It's kind of like both things are incredibly important, I believe, but sometimes you have to think only about one. And at other times, you force yourself to think about the other, I think.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. Yeah, the analogy would be sort of music, wouldn't it? I know, and it's like, you know, the people who are real artists, they'll make the music that they want to make. And, you know, there's that sort of purist kind of approach, which is, you know, screw the audience kind of thing. If I do what pleases me, then hopefully I'll find an audience who will also like it.
Sure.
And I suppose,
and I believe that is fundamentally true.
But like you say, you're putting a book in the world, and you know, you're competing with a lot of other people who are putting books into the world. So you got to think, you know, someone's going to pay, you know, your 30, 40 quid for a photo book. It's kind of daunting to think, well, why would they pick mine?
Yeah, and not just a few people, but actually, you know, close to 1,000 people.
Yeah, yeah.
Which that is quite daunting.
Yeah, in photo book terms, that's a lot. You know? I mean, if you're trying to, you know, be a novelist or something, it's a small number of people, but it's a totally different ball game altogether.
Mm.
So I guess books is kind of fundamentally what we're going to talk about, because you just got a new one out, London Ends, which is kind of your London. And it's funny, isn't it? Because you've been a Londoner for a long time, but in a way, this is your first London project.
Yeah.
It takes a long time sometimes to start shooting in your own backyard.
It does. It's funny because I've done two books now that are about the place I know best, the places I know best. And both books took me a long time to get started on.
Why?
I think it's to do with being or becoming an outsider and finding the right place, finding the place you're comfortable at for yourself to start working. So where my first book is about the little village in Germany I grew up in and German history, and more importantly, how we as Germans deal with history on a personal level, and particularly people from my generation. So it's a very, very personal book. I felt like when I left Germany, I was 19, and I mean, I was like all young people in a way. You want to get out of your, you grew up in a little place and you need to leave at some point. That's, I think, totally natural. But I was also somehow propelled, I mean, somehow upset, angry, uncomfortable. I didn't want to live in Germany. And it had something very important, I think. I mean, history, the way German history hangs over my generation, you know, we have nothing to do with the war, nor did my parents, but it really hangs over us. And I felt really weighed on us, and I felt that was unfair, and it made me angry, and I just wanted to leave. So I think I ended up in England more or less by accident. I hadn't planned to come here. But London really sort of caught my imagination when I came here for the first time. I came here on a sort of overnight flight on the return from America, and had never been to London before, or England, and had a few hours to spend between flights and just fell in love with the city and then wanted to come back.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, so it was almost pretty random in a way.
Yeah. But I found something here which was, in a way, everything I was looking for. I wasn't quite aware of what I was looking for, but it felt like a place that was incredibly liberal, tolerant, and open to ideas and people from all over the place.
Mm.
Everything that the place I'd grown up in was not, in a way. But that I mean, you know, that's just a small village. It's, they're like that anywhere in the world. I don't think that is particularly a German thing. And London was everything that obviously the village was not. So I felt compelled to come back and try to make a make a life here. And then it was a big break. You know, I was trying to start out, you know, I went to art school and I wanted to become a photographer, and it was new and exciting and very, very different from what I had grown up with. And so going back home became harder and harder in a way, because it reminded me of all the things I'd left behind. This is not personal, you know, I have wonderful parents and I had a wonderful upbringing and lots of good friends, but it was more the code of culture that I escaped.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so for many years, I didn't go home. For nearly 10 years, I really didn't go home, other than for a Christmas visit for a few days. And the idea of doing pictures there was almost suffocating. It was like, impossible. It was just too close and too familiar. And then it probably took about 10 or 12 years before I went to the documentary in Kassel with an Indian friend. We passed to my parents. We stayed a night, and he went, "You got a photograph here. This is amazing. This place. It's so, for, you know, for him being Indian, this sort of German orderliness, all the like little houses with their front gardens and the, you know, the clean roads and everything's organized. And for him, it was incredibly exotic
because he had the sort of outsider's perspective.
Yeah, and I hadn't realized, you know, that I had become an outsider as well. I mean, because I just assumed that if I go home, everyone I've always known is still there. And
it's also familiar to you. You can't imagine that would be of interest, right?
Yeah, exactly. To anyone. You know, why would that be of interest? So I then thought, okay, well, yeah, sure, I could do that. And then I realized, well, there's more to this. It's not just documenting a place that's terribly familiar, but there is this reason why I left and why I was uncomfortable. And well, yes, it has to do with the history. And then I discovered... I mean, I then thought quite hard about it. Like, what is it really that this is about? Yeah, I really tried to nail it, and I came up with this thought that there is a very, very strong disconnect that Germans of my generation certainly have with our own past, because we are overwhelmed with these 13 years of Nazi rule, all the things that happened in that period, all the horrible things that happened in that period. And all other German history is sort of lumped in one little corner that happened before. So it's almost like there is this black hole that sucks everything in, all the history. And Germany restarted, you know, 1945 at the end of the war. It's zero hour. Germany restarted. It's almost like it's a brand new country. It didn't exist before. Everything that came before had to be dismissed because it led to the rise of the Nazis. And like, in a way, you can read all German history before the Second World War as leading to what happened. You know, it's very hard not to. I mean, I had a conversation with a historian, and she I photographed her for a newspaper, for some portrait, and we ended up, she happened to write about the First World War, and she said, well, it's very hard for an historian to write about German history and not see it inevitably the sort of strands of the German psyche or the popular uprisings to lead somehow to the Nazi rise. And I felt that way. So growing up, Germany was this new country which was liberal and, well, conservative as well, but essentially not Nazi, right? Completely not. So it never made any sense. Like, where are they all? Where did they all go? You know?
Yeah.
And this disconnect is also, and then is I think what made me really uncomfortable, more than actually what happened. You know, I felt like, why can't we have a history? Why can't we talk about
the 18th century? Well, you know, I really wanted to ask you about all this because it's so fascinating. And I mean, you know, give us a sense of what it was like for your generation, because you grew up, like you say, it was like you're completely, you know, you weren't, even your parents were not really around.
No, they were born in 44 and 45.
Right, so. Okay. So they're born right at the end of the war. So it's something, you'd have to go back to your grandparents.
Who I never met.
Really?
My father's dad died in the early 70s before I was born, and my mom's dad died in the early 60s.
Right.
So they were both very, very... they both had a second wife, and they both had children very old.
Right.
So they were very old.
Yeah. But what did your parents... I mean, presumably you were curious about this stuff. What did your parents tell you about your grandparents? And were they... You know, was it a bit taboo to even really go there?
No, it wasn't taboo. I think it is... I mean, what I hear from friends who have grandparents, I mean, fathers in particular, who would have fought in the war, I hear that their grandfathers did not like talking about their experiences.
Mm. Of course,
yeah. Fair enough, yeah. So I have no personal experience with that because my grandfathers were dead long before I was born. And my grandmothers, lived in the countryside. So actually saw very little. They knew, my mom also talks about having a Russian and a French laborer who lived. My father and my grandfather had a bakery in the countryside. So I suppose the prisoners of war were sent to work with local businesses, forced labor. And so there was a French man and a Russian girl, I think, who lived with my grandfather and worked in the bakery. And they, I mean, there were many people who, well, many people, there were several people who worked in the bakery other than my grandfather. And they all shared a table over lunch and dinner. And they all lived in the house, so they were all more or less the same, except these were not there on their own, on their free will, these two.
Yeah.
But there are letters that I found of this Frenchman who, in the 50s, was still writing to my grandfather to see how my mom was doing, how it was going. So I don't have the sense that it was a particularly unhappy relationship, other than, I mean, it was war. I suppose everyone was somehow forced to do stuff they didn't want to do.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, I have no idea, I.
But
anyway, it's, I mean, the war was, it was very, the talking about the war happened all the time in school.
Right, because I was going to ask you about school and how it was, because, you know, I guess what's interesting is this weight that you felt, you know, which ultimately was one of the reasons you
guilt
got out. Is that what it was?
Yeah.
Even though, obviously, it was nothing to do with you, as it were.
Yeah, but it's a national guilt that is still, I mean, I don't know about the generation coming after us, but my generation, for sure, has been brought up that way.
Hmm.
You know, it's every year after year, for 13 years, we talk about the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And we go to the concentration camp, and we see the films of the liberation of the concentration camps, and we, I mean, it's you're impressionable as a young person. I mean, I'm not saying it's wrong, I'm just saying it's very powerful.
Hmm.
And so you can't help thinking at some point, enough, you know, I want to get away from this.
There's more to it. So, yeah, how did you kind of come to decide on, once you kind of went back and I guess this friend maybe put the idea in your head that mm-hmm. it was something you could shoot, is that mm-hmm. how it happened?
Yeah.
And then how did you sort of come by the theme, as it were?
Well, I approached it as a documentary project like I'd done before. I started going back, meeting people, doing portraits. I mean, my sort of approach very much was driven through portraiture, because I was doing a lot of portraits at the time as a photographer, as a commercial photographer, shooting for magazines, and I've always been drawn to portraiture, so portrait was a sort of natural form for me. And so I started meeting the people I hadn't seen in a long time. I mean, starting with spending more time with my parents, who I hadn't seen in their sort of everyday life. I suppose whenever I visited before, it was always a special occasion, so we have a meal and stuff like that, but just sort of spending time with them every day was new. And, you know, revisiting my old school and old friends I hadn't seen and all. You know, it's not easy, because people go, so what have you been up to the last 10 years? And you know, and I know so much about their lives, or so I think, because they still live in the same place. And they know nothing about my life. And so there's a lot of sort of translating work, literally.
Yeah.
But so it was both scary and also, in a way, really liberating. So in the beginning, it was a documentary project, and then I realized I wanted to talk about the past. But how do you do that?
Yeah, of pictures? Course.
I didn't want it to be very text-led. I really felt I wanted to do a picture project about it. I thought it had to be possible to do it with pictures. And then, so initially, I went to like historic sites to do pictures there, you know, like the concentration camp or monuments, and it didn't feel right. Because it's not of now. I wanted it to be contemporary.
Right.
Yeah. And I tried to capture this feeling of what it was like for me to grow up there. So that didn't work. And then the way I found that would work is I was looking for photographs, old photographs from the family album, but I wanted them to be equally contemporary. I didn't want them to. I wasn't looking for the sort of set up family portraits that people used to do quite a lot.
Mm.
But the sort of random pictures, you know, like stuff happening, everyday life pictures. And they're not that easy to find. And then I discovered my grandmom had, who hadn't married until her mid-30s because she was sort of an independent woman. She had a job and didn't want to get tied to some cripple, she used to say, because a lot of the men were crippled after the First World War.
Right.
So she never married until the Second World War, when her parents kind of arranged her to marry a much older man, my grandfather. But so she had taken a lot of pictures. She had a camera, and I found her photo albums, and there's a lovely, amazing, lively pictures of Germany between the two wars. But her pictures stop with the beginning of the war. There's no more pictures. And then there's pictures again after the war of my mom as a young child. My mom was born right at the end of the war. So I couldn't find any pictures in my parents' photo albums either. So not my grandmom's, not my other family members' albums that have sort of ended up in my parents' possession. And then I tried my uncles and I tried other people, and it turned out that nobody had pictures from that period in their photo albums. People had cameras in the Weimar Republic period, and Germany was prosperous enough for people to have cameras, and people were taking pictures, and there were lots of pictures, but I couldn't find any pictures from the war period at all. And most people said, well, they got lost, or don't know, maybe they were given away, or maybe we threw them out, I don't know, you know. And that kind of reinforced my feeling that there's this, even though the war is ever present on a sort of cultural, national, German level, on a personal level, people try to forget.
Trying to erase.
And it's just not there, you know.
Yeah.
And then I met this local historian who collects pictures from the village, and he's like, you know, you're not going to find any photographs. And he had a few, like two, three pictures of the sort of war period. And he said, people haven't got any. And if they have them, they're not going to give them to you. They're ashamed. Searched on, and I eventually found a great aunt who I hadn't seen since I was 12. And we had lots of cake and tea and conversation. And then she turned out to have photo albums with pictures of, and I found this picture just in the book of this sort of group of Nazis marching up the village street, which is still there, and the barn in front of which my parents got married, it's still there. And yeah, they sent the Nazi flag and blah, 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 marching. And it was quite sort of a shock to see it happen in this place that I knew so well.
Yeah, yeah.
Where, you know, you'd never met a Nazi because they didn't exist anymore, right? And all the history is in other places, is in, I don't know, Berlin or Munich, or, you know, it's not in your village. So suddenly I found these pictures, I managed to create this continuity between my grandmom's pictures, which were from the 20s, the Weimar Republic period, and then these pictures from the Nazi period from the village, and then my own pictures.
Mm. So yeah, so you must have felt like a bit of a detective in a way, you know, with that. It must have been quite fun. But at that stage, had you already decided that you were going to use them, or were you just curious to see them?
I thought I'd use them. Yeah,
right.
And this is at the end stage. I mean, I sat with a project for a few years, and I wondered how to finish it.
Right.
And then this was the final puzzle,
the final piece
of the puzzle. I mean, it kind of made sense with them. And another thing was important to crop the pictures. So I didn't want the nostalgia attached to old photographs, you know, the like frilly corner edges or the gilded edges. I didn't want that. I just wanted the picture. I wanted them to be as contemporary as possible.
Yeah.
So I cropped them to the same square format that the Hasselblad 66 pictures.
Right.
And then they often sit next, side by side with my pictures as well, and the same size. And I really wanted them to be, I want to concentrate on the content rather than the way they're presented.
Yeah. So most of the people in those images that you shot up are family members or friends or people you knew from way back.
Yeah.
Having done that, where did it leave you in terms of kind of resolving all those feelings that you kind of left with? Did it have an impact on that?
Yeah, it felt really good. It felt like a catharsis.
Yeah.
I've often said that.
Yeah,
it's true. It's kind of almost like what this sort of personal work is meant to do. I mean, you're trying to resolve something. Otherwise, why would you do it? I mean, I don't believe that I'm more interesting than the next person. I just, this was something that was needing resolution. And I discovered that And I was totally, I was very, very nervous when I published this book because, I don't know, people might get upset or people might feel embarrassed. I mean, in back home, my parents, I don't know, I had 1,000 nightmares over it.
Really?
Yeah, and it had a mixed reception back home. I mean, people were maybe not flattered, but it turns out now, a few years later, people are quite proud of it.
Mm. You're talking about the people you actually photographed, right?
Yeah. I've always shown pictures to the people.
Yeah.
I mean, they're very close to me. I mean, they're my parents and they're close friends. And
But did most of them understand what it was about?
Absolutely. They got it. Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, people thought maybe, it's just sort of the same feeling I used to have, like, oh, God, stop already. You know, why again the war and all that?
Mm-hmm.
So it was a put,
but in a way, it was a way for you to put a full stop at the end of all that.
It was, and it feels totally resolved. It's almost like a little bit of psychotherapy. Mm,
absolutely, yeah. Which is as good a reason for doing, anything.
It is, yeah.
Art. I was listening to David Alan Harvey earlier, and he was talking about, how basically, all art comes from pain of some sort, and not necessarily some trauma, but the fact that you had this kind of even just anxiety about it, or this feeling of, and like you say, maybe is what it's all for at the end of the day.
Maybe, yeah.
But did it sell, did you get distribution in Germany, or did you, you've published it through your own imprint.
So I tried to show it in Germany, and I had some introductions from people who liked it to 6 or 7 spaces in Germany. And it was turned down everywhere. So I haven't shown it in Germany at all, actually. It sold okay. I haven't also, it wasn't published either. There's a place in Hamburg that is very good. It's called the Deichtorhallen. They do a lot of photography exhibitions. And they have a bookshop. And he sold quite a lot in his bookshop.
Mm.
So I think there's I don't know what it is, a cautiousness, or maybe it's a oversaturation.
Yeah.
It could be either. Of this type of, not this type, but of anything to do with the war in general, so it's either a cautiousness or an over-saturation. Because, like I said, growing up in Germany, you can't escape the subject.
Mm.
It's everywhere. But I feel still it's done very black and white. There is never any, maybe that's changing now. It's everything to do with the war is bad. There's nothing ever, that's just how it is, full stop. You can't argue that. So,
mm-hmm.
So therefore, if you are a director making a movie, or if you're right, the subject is just treated black and white, end of story, human life is never like that, we know that, but if you're a German and you do anything about the war, it's got to be black and white. End of story. I guess that's also what people are a bit bored of it, in a way. If you can say that without sounding terribly rude, but and interestingly, there's a German writer who lived in the UK a long time. He taught a writing course at Norwich University. His name is Sibbald, who wrote a series of lectures. He gave a series of lectures, which were later published in a book called On the Natural History of Destruction. And the lectures were about the fact that German literature did not at all reflect the almost complete destruction of 140 odd cities during the war, and what that meant to, tens of millions of German people. We all know about Dresden, and Dresden is there's a national monument with a sort of laying of a wreath every year. But 140 German cities got completely annihilated, and what that meant to the people who lived there. We're talking Aleppo-style stuff all over Germany. And it has not found its way into German literature or movie making or any kind of culture at all.
Right.
Like, not completely. Not at all. There's one unpublished book. Well, it's now published, but it hasn't been published until the late 80s by one of the greatest German writers, Hermann Böll, who is one of my favorite writers. And he wrote a book about it set in Köln, which was entirely destroyed as well. And this book didn't find a publisher in Germany because it doesn't talk about the destruction. It's just set in a completely destroyed city, and he couldn't publish it. And so this guy, this English, being a German writer in England, giving him an outsider's perspective on the German landscape, he gave a series of lectures in the late 90s in Zurich in Switzerland about the subject, about the fact that why isn't it there? And he was really, really heavily attacked by the left media, being an apologist, being, you know, you can't feel sorry for Germans, right. You know, we brought on us ourselves. Germans can never be seen as victims. I mean, you know, he wasn't an apologist. He was just, yeah. I mean, he's a writer, and he gave a literally lecture to a bunch of other writers. He was saying, how come this subject hasn't been broached? Yeah. It's really interesting. So even then, it was still raw, you know, like it's still stuff you can't say.
So it's like you're not allowed to you know, kind of to acknowledge the fact that there was a vast amount of destruction and suffering in Germany because of the guilt,
yeah,
it's all our fault.
Yeah, exactly.
We had it coming kind of thing.
So, you know, this is this extreme black and white.
That's interesting.
You're stuck with. Anyhow,
So in a way, I was going to say, you know, this. So, we didn't mention the title of the book is Land Without Past.
Yeah.
Your new book, your London book, which just came out, it's called London Ends. You know, is there some in your mind? Is there a definite kind of continuity between those two books then, or there's a commonality?
There's an element of continuity in the sense that London is my new home. I've been here nearly 20 years now, and here's another book about a home, right? But I think that is almost where the commonality ends, because this book is much, in my mind anyway, much, much freer. The photography is much, much freer. There isn't this heavy shadow that hangs over me as a photographer.
It's more playful, do you think?
Yeah, I think so, and it's more fun, and I really enjoy it. And enjoyed going around London and discovering the place because it's so, you know, it's all these things that brought me here many years ago and then maybe now are all called in question with this dreadful Brexit business. But the city doesn't prescribe on people how they have to live or be or enjoy themselves or so much as it coming from Germany, which is so prescriptive in so many ways, there's one way of doing things.
Right.
Coming to London felt incredibly liberating.
So, you know, I mean, you're very much a bona fide Londoner. You've been here plenty long enough to kind of, you know, pass that test, as it were. But do you think somehow also being a foreigner gave you a fresh, you know, different perspective on the London project?
It's hard to know. I mean, I think generally as a photographer, you always need to find an outsider's point of view, even if you're treating really familiar subjects. If you photograph your children or your family or something terribly close to you, or yourself, self-portraits, we always strive to somehow make things strange, to somehow get a different angle, look at them with fresh eyes. That is part of what we do. I think otherwise you're just repeating stereotypes, right?
I mean,
that is something I think. So when I first came to London and I first started studying photography, I had fresh eyes. Why didn't I do it then?
You know? Well, exactly. That's what I was thinking.
Exactly. The answers I have no idea, but probably because it was just too overwhelming, you know, where to start. It's a big place, and I wasn't interested in photographing the center, the places that are well known. I wanted to photograph the hinterland, you know, I wanted to look for a new narrative, something that isn't so often talked about, which is again something that we do as photographers.
Because you were saying when you used to kind of explore on your bike when you first came.
Yeah, and didn't photograph at all.
You just wanted to have a sense of the you know, environment that you were now living in.
Yeah, I used to cycle around and get lost and then try to find my way back and you know, go from A to B, but take a different route every time in order to get lost, in order to discover new parts of town. To me, it was like a massive unexplored jungle. I loved losing myself and finding myself. And to me, it all seems incredibly exotic and exciting. I mean, that's just me. I mean, I know London can also seem very drab and unexciting to other people, but to me, it's it's this magic place.
So when did it become a serious project?
It was a long journey, in fact, because it starts with the last picture in the book, which is from this series, 10 Minutes, One Afternoon in Whitechapel, which I won the Observer Award with many years ago, which was kind of the first time I achieved any sort of recognition as a photographer. And it was incredibly important to me at the time, and probably still sort of echoes. And that picture wasn't that I set out to photograph London at all. I came home and it was snowing. I came home on my bicycle like so many days. I was completely wet and I didn't have a camera on me. But it was this blizzard in Whitechapel and I lived on the market. My front door led out to the market. So it was this very familiar place that I saw every day. I got home and I was freezing cold, but I was like, gotta photograph this. I don't know. You know, it's amazing. It looks so different today. So I ran up, got my camera, had two rolls of film, and I think it was 800 film that I pushed two stops because it was dark and snowy, you know, and I just took two rolls of film, so 20 shots, and six or seven of them went into this exhibition at the Observer.
Mm.
So, yeah, happy day. But then on the back of this work, these pictures, I got work shooting in Outer London. For architects and for City Hall and other things like that. So really that then, I'd always explored London and suddenly I was doing it for a living as well.
Right.
And then it sort of was, okay, I love this, this is great.
Yeah.
Let's put this together. But it took a few years, you know?
Yeah.
I wasn't, London is a bit like, you know, wherever you, it isn't one construct, you know, because of its history. It's so different. Yeah, so similar.
Mm.
You know, some bits like Harrow are made by private landlords to house the new middle classes. You know, out of London, other bits have like the historic links with the dockyard, with the docks. You know, in the east, or there are cities that got swallowed up, like Croydon, or you know, old villages that have been there for 500, 600, 700 years, and now they're part of London, or you know, other bits used to be Essex and now they're in London. I mean, so there's so much history so London has come together from so many different directions, yeah. And it's very hard to say it is like this, but that is what I was attempting to do, particularly with Outer London, I guess.
Yeah,
so it took me many years.
And
to be satisfied.
But it's kind of interesting that, you know, in a way it came out of being, you know, commissioned by various people to go out and do a job. I kind of like to collect examples of that happening because it's quite nice that, you know, personal projects sometimes come out of fairly banal, you know, everyday commissions.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting to note that.
It is. And I think in my case, terribly important because the kind of place I come from, the kind of background I come from, you have to have a job. You know, I was brought up that way and it was sort of like, okay, I could try and be an artist, but I'd have to make a living. So I went to art school and came out with a bunch of debt and either I make a living as a photographer or I drop the whole thing and, you know, become a doctor, right. Which was the plan A was to become a doctor. So, I had to prove to myself and to my family that I could make a living. And so I became a portrait photographer. I did magazine work and all that sort of thing. So in a way, that period, I couldn't really convince myself to do a personal project. I could give myself that luxury to go off and do pictures for my artistic satisfaction. Had to be work in a way.
Right.
That's
interesting. Did you find it relatively easy to find images? Because, you know, I think when you collect a whole, you know, a lot of work into one book and there's 54 pictures or whatever, it makes it seem easy. But I can imagine there were days and days of kind of being out in the middle of Newham or something and really not finding anything. Is that the case or did you have kind of more luck than that? Or wouldn't call it luck probably, but
I think what hardly ever happens is that you go and shoot something for a job and then it turns out to become art. And that doesn't really happen. So there are a few pictures in the book where that did happen. So that it was just a job, and they were just, you know, great, and I thought they fitted, and I put them in the book. But most of the pictures happened because I decided to do the book, and then I look for stuff.
Yeah, but that's kind of what I'm talking about. But even when you're looking, there are times when
you don't find
things.
Yeah, of course.
How do you personally deal with that situation? Because I think everyone has their own kind of way, you know, the sort of self-talk, what you're saying to yourself. Because, it's very easy to get despondent when, you know, it's a kind of wet Wednesday in the arse end of nowhere, literally.
But that's great. I mean, I love those days. I mean, I'm most happy when I'm going to really a place that where on the face of it there's nothing to photograph and it's completely mundane, and that's when I'm kind of most at ease, because in a way the pressure is off, right? It's like you're not going to be able to do a good picture, but then I'm going to try anyway, because that is what I mean. I love that. Really love that.
So you like the challenge in a way?
Yeah. I love making good pictures when, like, I can be expected not to do any pictures at all because today it's raining. But one of my favorite pictures from the project is, it was raining, like, I mean, you know, this rain you get on the islands, you know, it's kind of swamping you. And I was sprinting for cover, and I took this picture of the horse decked out in the Indian wedding regalia.
Yeah.
I was actually heading for the horse trailer to seek shelter because it was raining so hard. And as I was running across the road, I was taking this picture. I stopped to take the picture. I took two frames, and then I was drenched, and I ran into the horse trailer. But it's... I would find that the more intense your experience, the somehow more interesting your pictures.
As well. Absolutely.
I just wanted to say, so I'd started almost like collecting these pictures from random places in London. And when I decided that it ought to be a book, because London means so much to me and discovering the place means so much to me, I then went about it a little bit more organized to make it into a book, to shape it. So one big thing I did is this walk.
Right, I was going to ask you about that. So you did a sort of 10-day walk, which you'd kind of decided. But you could have come home every night. Why did you not?
Because it had to be, like I was saying earlier, it had to be this experience. And I wanted that to feed into the book. So Olivia came with me, Olivia, my wife. And
you took the missus.
She helped me organize places to stay for the walk. And she we set up a Tumblr and a Facebook page, and she took pictures on her iPhone that she uploaded. She was also like sort of more of a support company.
Yeah, it's nice because otherwise it's a pretty lonely kind of business. And I guess you get the dynamic.
But such an amazing adventure. I mean, honestly, going on an adventure in your hometown.
That's
exactly amazing.
I've got that written here. You know, you kind of created a little adventure in your own doorstep. You don't have to go to some exotic corner of the world.
I mean, somebody else asked me whether that you can only do that in London or whether you could do that in other places too. The honest answer is I have no idea. My suspicion is that London is particularly well suited because it's big enough, I guess. And also, it's never been master planned. So it's not like you know what you're going to find. I mean, to a degree you do. You know, there's always going to be terraced houses and high streets. But other than that, you'll find all sorts of things, historic buildings or...
I suppose that's the challenge as a storyteller in a way, isn't it? I mean, you happen to be a photographer, but I don't know why, but it came to mind that, you know, Will Self did this thing where he walked in LA, where he walked, because of course LA is famous for the fact that no one ever walks anywhere. So of course he decided that that's why he would walk from the airport into the city or whatever. Now, I've not read it, but it kind of strikes me as a kind of similar conceit, you know.
Interesting, I don't know that.
But because he's a good writer, I imagine it's a pretty entertaining book. Yeah. Don't know, but, you know, it's a similar thing.
I tried to do something similar once. I tried to walk in New York in the Bronx from the end of the tube line to the beach.
Right.
Which is mental, because no one ever does that. So you walk, kind of, you scamper along a sort of dual carriageway, and there's not even enough space to, like, not... you know, not get run over by cars on the edge of the road. So you kind of jump down a ditch into the woods in order to, I mean, it was horrendous.
Yeah. Sometimes you have to put yourself in weird situations. But were you quite meticulous in planning your 10-day trip, or did you let things just unfold, you know, organically?
Good question. No, and yes. I mean, there had to be an element of planning because we had to stay the nights. And we didn't want to stay in hotels because that would have been too easy. Anyway. Mm. And also that, I mean, I don't know, hotels everywhere we went. But so we used this website called homestaybooking.com, little plug there, which is sort of like Airbnb, but it felt more sort of homemade, more grassroots, and it's also cheaper.
Oh, so it's like people who have spare are rooms. Actually living there and they let you stay.
Nice. Yeah. So we stayed sort of £15 a night on average for the two of us.
Brilliant.
Yeah. And we met people.
Yeah.
So that was the other thing. We wanted to meet people along the way. So we had to know more or less where we spend the nights, all nights before we got going. Hmm. There's a couple of unknowns towards the end of the trip. We planned it to be 10 days because it is a long way.
Yeah.
I kind of knew where I wanted to go, having had these experiences of discovering London photographically previously. I wanted to go east over the new Olympic Park through Stratford out east. You know, I'd never been to West Ham and East Ham and all these places, so I knew I wanted to visit. I knew I wanted to go to Romford and then Dagenham, and I knew I wanted to go to Woolwich and where the new Crossrail stops, Abbey Wood and Belvedere, these areas. Then when I first lived in London, I lived in this place called Chislehurst, so I knew I wanted to go back there. There were these caves that I'd never been to that I wanted to go and explore. Then South London was a bit sort of a blank canvas for me. I'd done South London very well, but I knew I wanted to go to Richmond and to Heathrow Airport, which is then West London, obviously, because I've always wanted to go to that little park where the plane spotters hang out.
Yeah, was it Hounslow or somewhere?
I think it's Hatton Cross.
Right. That sounds right. That's very near Heathrow, isn't it?
It's by the Southern Runway. Yeah.
Is that where the plane spotters go?
Mm.
Okay.
One of the places, I suppose, but this is very near a runway.
Mm.
It's the Southern Runway, and. So these, I sort of, Northwest London, I didn't know very well. So it was more kind of go see what we find and then where could we find accommodation. That was always, obviously, you know, okay, we could find accommodation here, so we'd have to go there.
Right.
You know, and so we'd have to plan a little bit around that. But anything that happened between the accommodations was kind of made up along the way.
And it's essentially you've done a circular trip around the edges.
Not the edge of London. I mean, that is the M25, like Ian Sinclair did.
Right, yeah.
But I was more interested in all these they're sort of in between places. They're places that are far enough from the centre to traditionally be cheaper for rent for people to live in, but they aren't far enough out to be, you know, comfortable green suburbs.
Yeah, it'd be like the kind of middle ring of a target in a way.
I mean, that's true in kind of northeast and east London, and to a degree southeast London. But then south and southwest London is just very residential.
Mm.
It doesn't. I mean, that it doesn't have this in between area that I was particularly interested in.
Mm.
Not so much.
I wanted to ask you about, you know, how do you create a particular mood or atmosphere or consistency of tone when you're putting a project like this together? You know, do you think about it while you're shooting, or is it very much in the editing where that happens?
Sure, the editing has something to do with it, but there's a lot of different, I suppose, tones over a book of 50-odd pictures.
Right. But there has to be some kind of underlying...
Yeah, maybe that is to do with... I don't know. The way you shoot, shoot, you know, on a medium format camera, and England has very consistent light. It's always a little bit overcast. It's you know, never too bright. It's
what time of year was it that when you did the walk?
September.
Okay.
End of September, early October.
Right. And so kind of coming into autumn.
But it was actually like summer-like. I mean, we were sweating. It was hot.
Right.
Apart from one day when it was raining, where this horse picture happened. The rest of the other 9 days was.
Nice weather.
I mean, hot. Yeah.
Wow.
Really hot.
Which is
blue skies
in itself.
Unusual.
Unusual for London. Like a couple of months a year. No, not even that. I'm wondering about Olivia, your wife. She's also a photographer, yeah, previously of this parish. People can go back and find her interview that we did a while back. But yeah, is she important to you as a kind of a dispassionate third party, as it were, when it comes to editing?
Not dispassionate.
Well, you know what I mean. I mean, objective.
But important, yes.
Because I think, and I'm probably you provide the same kind of
yes,
tool for her, service for her, as it were, yeah, when she's doing her books.
Yeah.
Do you think it's important to have that, you know, kind
of? Yes, absolutely. I mean, we are lucky in a way that we have this at home. We have each other to support each other with our work, and we're constantly feedbacking. And certainly when it comes to making a book, we are each other's most crucial helpers, I suppose, and editors. Editing is incredibly important. I'm sure every photographer knows that we are our worst own editors. I mean, because you can't help being very involved with your pictures. You know what happened around you and how hard it was to do this particular picture. So you find often in your own pictures things that other people just don't see because they aren't there.
No, exactly.
You
know? Yeah.
Or you have to spend a lot of time explaining it to people, yeah, why this picture is important. And I find that we have to learn as photographers, I suppose it's true for any art writers too, I guess, to edit our work.
Mm.
And often, I mean, we can learn to edit our work, but there's also things we can't do ourselves.
Yeah, yeah.
We need someone else to edit our work.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it's really, really important. Even if you become really good at it, and you learn, you know what it is to look for, what to look out for, where are the pitfalls, what have you got to avoid, what have you got to pay attention to, you still need someone else to do it for you. And that person needs to be someone you really, really trust, and who's, I mean, editing can be done in a thousand ways. Everyone have a different way of doing it, but there are certain things that are somehow, if you like, rules or stuff that works, and so you need to have someone you believe they think about editing in a way that you do. I mean, they want to arrive at the same destination that you want to be in with your work, and also someone so someone you respect and also someone you trust.
Yeah.
So finding that person can be very, very hard, I think.
Yeah, too right. Yeah, and I suppose it's tempting to also maybe get to a point where you maybe ask several people and then everyone's got an opinion and then yeah, it all goes to hell, because really, yeah, in a way, yeah, at the end of the day, you've got to decide for yourself. But were there any, yeah, I mean, any examples where you just kind of dug in and you know, just there were certain pictures that you had to...
With the editing, you mean?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, there's about 54 pictures in the book, and I had about 200 that I considered that were in my closer edit in the beginning of the year. And so, yeah, they come. I mean, but you know, you end up, you don't want to repeat yourself too often in anything you do. And it comes down to sort of 2-3 pictures. They say similar things, or they have similar atmospheres, or they play similar roles in the flow or in the book. And it comes to choosing one of the three. And then it's sort of taste, really.
Yeah.
I mean, often there isn't much in between them. They're all good, say.
Yeah.
Hopefully,
yeah.
And then it's a choice, and then I can be overruled. But normally we kind of agree on stuff.
I mean, I'm going through this myself at the moment. I'm trying to edit a kind of long term thing, and you're right. It's just so difficult. You become very, almost, it becomes almost impossible to be objective about the pitch, especially ones that you've been living with for years, and you have very sort of, you know, you have very sort of emotional reactions to them, and yeah, you need that other opinion.
But people have editors. Writers have editors.
Yeah.
Musicians have editors. Producers. I mean, they're really important in all creative output.
Yeah.
I think people, maybe photographers, forget. I mean, because we don't, there isn't an infrastructure of bookmaking that is as advanced or as entrenched as it is in the music industry or the film industry or in the writing industry. We are out there on our own and we make our things, and maybe we're lucky and we go with like a big established publisher and they'll put their input in, but most of the time these days it's somehow an enterprise of a one-person enterprise, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. You're sort of, yeah, there's a kind of expectation that you should be able to do it. Do it all.
The photographer, of course, you should do it. Yeah. It's your business, but it isn't. I mean, it's not necessarily just you. There is an editor. I think is important. It's a really crucial thing. And I've seen many, many good photography projects that are terribly edited and that suffer because they're badly edited.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, also because, I mean, you're sort of almost more in touch with this stuff than other people because you have your own imprint, Fish Bar, you and Olivia, your wife. And so you have, in recent times, taken on the business of working with other people's stuff, and has that helped you in a way when it comes to making your own?
I think
edits?
So. Yes. I don't teach very often, but whenever I do, I find the process of editing people's work incredibly helpful. I always learn a lot of it, and so the first time I edited someone else's work in earnest was Pablo Bartholomew. And his father Richard's work for our first exhibition at Fish Bar. I mean, it was Olivia and I together. And I found it both an amazing amount of trust that Pablo paid in us to allow us to edit this work. And a large responsibility, because I suddenly realized that I am shaping this work. It could be one thing, it could be another thing, it could be a third thing. But what it is going to be in our space is up to us. So I thought to myself, wow, I'm been given this freedom by this man who's, you know, quite a lot older than I am, very experienced, and he's had great shows, and that was quite something. I really liked that, and thought we did a good job with it too. So I was proud of it in the end, and I felt I learned a lot from the process for my own photography, because I learned that some pictures don't have to be well composed, don't have to be perfect, in order to do something really important in a larger body of work.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Now that's a really interesting point. Yeah. So it's not necessarily about the strength of the individual image; it's about how it works or how important it is within the edit.
Yeah. I do believe all pictures have to be strong, but if there's a picture you choose to take home, put on your wall, that's going to be a particular type of picture that you want to live with for the rest of your life, like this one here, for instance. Sorry, a picture on my wall from this particular exhibition. But that doesn't mean that all the pictures have to be like that.
Right?
Yeah. There's some pictures that are strong but work in the context. I mean, I don't believe in weak photographs. I mean, and what makes a strong or a weak picture is difficult to describe, but in my mind, I'm anyway clear what is a strong picture. They don't all have to be pictures individually you want to live with for the rest of your life, but they all have to they all work with each other.
Yeah. Can you see yourself working on more London projects in the future, having done this
probably one? Yes.
Yeah. Was that walk that you did together, was that pre-parenthood, because you've got a young daughter now, so I guess things have changed in a way. It's partly a response to the kind of practicalities of doing that.
Yeah, we did this walk, then Olivia went off to do a residency in Dubai, which led to her second book, Stranger, which we published in May last year, just after our daughter was born, and then we had to take some time out. It's all, you can do quite a lot. I mean, you know, Olivia was the pregnant one, but you can do quite a lot, it seems, with a big belly and a tiny baby. But then at some point, after a few months, they really take over. Like they really, really ask for a lot of your time and brain power as well, it seems.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, then there was a year and a half where we did very little.
Yeah. So just out of interest, I mean, the sacrifices and compromises that come with parenthood, has that been roughly as you imagined it would be, or has it been worse, or has it been kind of slightly, you know, slightly better? Because you must have thought
it's been much more amazing than I thought.
Right. Yeah, that's a nice
amazing
answer.
Amazing. I mean, brilliant.
Yeah. So all worth it.
Definitely.
So as far as Fish Bar goes, I mean, as I said, I mean, for people who don't know, that it's a publishing, you know, it's an imprint, and it's also a little space that you have here in London, which you can use as a gallery space for your own work and for other people's. But how's that worked out in terms of how you, what your expectation was? Have you, has it come with any sort of surprises, or have you learned any valuable lessons from doing it? About maybe about the economics of book publishing,
yes.
For instance.
That, I mean, we could probably do another podcast about that.
Yeah, maybe we should one time.
Gosh, what was the...
I don't know if there was a question in there somewhere. Some of my questions can be a bit vague, Phil. I apologize for that. But I'm wondering about...
Like I said, we could do another podcast about that. There is...
I mean, you're not making any money out of it.
No, the opposite. I mean, we... Right. It.
Can you imagine a time when it could be at least something that, you know, brings in a little bit of income?
I can imagine that time. But the big question I always ask is are you selling books?
Yeah.
You know, or are you selling prints? And I'm asking other photographers or other publishers, and the general answer I get is no. So either everyone's lying to me or we are doing something wrong. I mean, we're lucky enough to kind of break even, but you know, we don't, I mean, what do you, we never account for our own time, obviously. So we come for free, you know?
Right. If you were factoring that in,
we're not accounting for heating, you know, right, I mean, that comes for free, you know, I mean, that's
There's different,
as a business model, I think we'd get a big F,
yeah,
you know, I
exactly.
mean, clearly,
but,
well, the but is obviously the fantastic, freedom that we've created for ourselves to do what we want to do, and I hope we show things in a way that make other people enjoy and appreciate what we do. And it became pretty clear to us a few years ago that you couldn't just be a photographer anymore. The world is changing. The media world is changing. You know, when I started out, I wanted to be a magazine photographer, and I thought that would be the thing I'd do. You know, I loved the idea of doing that. And it sort of, I did it for a few years, and it became increasingly obvious that it was a sort of dying profession, if you want.
Yeah.
And so you can't just be a photographer anymore. That, I think those days are over. Mm. And if you want to be a photographer, if you want to do photography, then you could be creative with your output, how you put it out, where you put it out, and also demand a lot more of yourself. Don't expect you can just go and do pictures and then someone else would take care of the rest, as in shaping it, editing it, publishing it, paying for it. Yeah, it's incredibly complex. I mean, you were saying in the beginning of this conversation that it is a good time to be in the photo book industry because people are incredibly enthusiastic, and the audiences are constantly growing, so it seems. And I agree, it is a good time. I suppose 15 years ago, if you were trying to be a self-publisher, you'd be lost, because where would you sell your books? I mean, you know, bookshops wouldn't even look at you, and we didn't have the internet in the same way we have it now, you know, with e-commerce. And yes, there wouldn't be a chance. So 15 years ago, you could try to do, you know, get a publishing deal with Thames & Hudson or Fiden, or forget about it.
Yeah.
So yes, we are at a great time where there's photo book festivals all over the place. I mean, every small town has one now, and their audience, people go there, and you know, and it's great. But it is a lot of legwork. There isn't an easy channel of just putting out your work. So you have to do all the legwork, and you've got to be a producer, you've got to be an editor, you've got to be a publisher, you've got to be a businessman, you've got to be a photographer, you've got to be an artist, you've got to be all these things now, and it's quite a challenge, as well as maybe, you know, having a family and all the rest of things that we do with our lives. So it's complicated, but when it works, it's all the more satisfying. You can be proud of yourself, and when it doesn't work, it seems it's just too much.
It's going to be interesting to see how things, you know, kind of pan out, because everything's changed so dramatically. But I think it might be a good time for making photographs, as long as no one expects to make a living out of it. But the kind of reward is the thing itself, because I think, as we were saying earlier, there's really no comparison between looking at a nice, well-produced photo book and looking at those images on a computer screen.
I agree.
So Any recommendations for photo books that you want to pass on? I'm not going to allow you to have any of your wives, even though you might want
from
to.
All the Fishbar publications.
You can have a Fishbar.
I am a little bit guilty of not having, in the last couple of years, sort of disengaged a little bit, making my own books, also disengaged from the book world as a whole, because I felt terribly overwhelmed, and also I've been a father, so that's a good excuse.
Yeah.
More recently, I bought one photo book, and that was Gregory Halpern, right?
Yeah, that sounds right.
XYYZ.
Yes, that's it.
Which I thought was excellent.
Right. Okay.
Also, just won some big award in Paris, right?
Paris photo.
Aperture, yeah.
Yeah.
So I felt vindicated in my taste.
But yeah, yeah.
No, great. Love it. And okay. I love that it has no writing in it.
Right.
I love a book that is, full of good pictures, good photography, and has the self-confidence of saying, I can tell this story with my pictures. So appreciate that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, I'll put a link to that on the website. So, all right, last question. What advice would you give to that sort of 19-year-old self who, when you first came to London or you first started doing photography, I think you did a course at London College of Printing, which is or London College of Communication, as is now. A lot of past guests have been to that place, including myself. But what advice would you give yourself?
Another podcast.
There's so much.
Would I give myself or other people?
Well, I guess it's the same. It's the same thing in a way. But you can.
I think do that personal work. I said earlier that I almost said to myself. I think I said to myself at some point, I'm not going to do any pictures unless I'm going to get paid for them, because otherwise I'm not going to be a photographer, right?
Yeah, and, you didn't want to be an amateur.
I didn't want to be. I didn't want to be a dreamer in a way. I wanted to be. You know, I wanted this to be serious. I wanted this to make me a living, you know. I wanted to be successful, but that was important. I needed to make a living, you know. So no pictures unless I'm getting paid for them, I said to myself. And you can't do that. I mean, if you choose to be an artist, say, you have to do it not for commercial reasons. And that is that's a really hard thing to say, because I also fully believe that you got to make a living. I mean, what else are you going to do?
Yeah, sure. Unless you got some secret source of
there's wealth. That. I mean, I think there's a lot of that actually in the art world. But nonetheless, I think my advice to myself would be you got to take pictures even when you don't get paid for them, because that is what keeps you alive as an artist, as a photographer. If you don't allow yourself that, then you're going to be frustrated.
Okay, I think that's a good spot to stop. Thanks for chatting. It's really nice talking to you.
Likewise.
So the new book is London Ends, Fishbar. What's the website for Fishbar?
Fishbar.ph, as in photography.
Okay.
Or the Philippines.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So, that's where people can find it. Thanks, Philip.
You're welcome.